The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy.
Yeah. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On January 17th, 1993, a fire ripped through two adjacent apartment buildings in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Many onlookers, including a man named Dan Carnevale, witnessed the mayhem that took three lives. Soon, information was released to the media that two blank checks and a set of keys had been taken from the apartment building. Dan Carnevale's roommates once found a number of old checks from that apartment complex under his bed, so they reported him to the police. After Dan convinced police that he had come upon the blaze after the fact, he was released and he moved to California. The case went cold for nearly 14 years until an eyewitness came forward with a different account of Dan's whereabouts that night. Dan was dragged back to Pennsylvania, where he allegedly confessed to a fellow inmate while awaiting trial, saying that he was in fact the culprit all those many years ago. But this is wrongful conviction. Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison. Now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and leave us a message. Tell us how these powerful, often tragic stories make you feel. Outraged, inspired, motivated? We want to know. We may even include your story in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where we've got an alleged arson case out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, again involving ATF agents William Petritis and Jason Wick, as well as ATF chemist William Kennard. And you may remember one or all of them from the cases of Greg Brown and Christine Bunch. And of course, we'll have both of those stories linked in the episode description. But now we're going to hear from another one of their victims, Dan Carnevale. Dan, I'm so sorry for the reason you're here and for what you went through, but we're so happy and honored to have you here today.
Thank you.
And joining him, you may recognize her from our coverage of Greg Brown's case. She's the managing attorney of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, Liz DeLosa.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you. And last but not least, Dan's civil attorney, Alec Wright. Alec, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Alec, my understanding is that you're also from Pittsburgh, but this fire happened way back in 93 when you were still just a kid, while Dan at the time was already 29. But crazily, he didn't get prosecuted until 14 years after that. But before we unpack all of that, Dan, I want to hear more about what it was like growing up in Pittsburgh and being a teenager in the Steel City at that time. You were raised in Polish Hill, right?
Yes, I grew up on Polish Hill in Pittsburgh. I mean, I did everything every other teenager did. Drank beer in the woods.
Well, if I grew up there, I pretty much can guarantee I would have been right next to you.
That makes all of us, except for Alec.
My house, Dan, just so you know, had the woods behind it where we stashed the beer. Steel City Reserve, Dan, was that a beer that you guys had in Polish Hill?
Yeah, but I derailed the night train a few times, too.
During his 20s, Dan moved across Pittsburgh to the tightly knit Italian neighborhood of Bloomfield, where he was familiar with the buildings in which the 1993 fire occurred.
I made some mistakes growing up, and I had some hard times in my 20s. I was a mail thief. That was what linked me to the building, because I was stealing their mail from their mailboxes. I would get the checks from the building and take them to Polish Hill and have somebody cash them for me. I mean, I drank out every night, practically. I like to buy drinks and make myself look like I had money. And that night was no exception. I just went to the Luna. They'd have karaoke. They'd have a DJ, whatever. And I'd hang out there until they closed. And then I'd walk back to Bloomfield where I lived. Most of that night, I don't remember. But I do remember being at the sandwich shop. And I was with other people watching the fire. And there was just a load of people there and people hanging out the windows, people screaming and yelling. I remember that.
During the early morning hours of January 17th, 1993, while Dan was closing down the Luna Bar and headed to a local sandwich shop, a fire began at the nearby Columbia apartment building and spread next door to an apartment building called the Regal.
Emergency calls started to come in around 4 a.m. By 5:30, it's a 6-alarm fire. The fire has moved from where it began in the basement all the way to the roof, and the northwest corner of the Columbia apartment building collapses. 3 apartment residents are killed. 1 visitor is very severely injured.
That was 20-year-old Linda McCutcheon, who was staying with her friend, 22-year-old Christopher Stallman, who leapt to his death to escape the flames. 63-year-old Lawrence Lichko and 31-year-old Anita Emery died from smoke inhalation. Thankfully, 29 other residents managed to survive, and they all reported the same thing.
In the weeks prior to the fire, witnesses would later tell investigators that they had like buzzing and clicking and banging within their radiators, that some apartments were really hot and some apartments were not receiving heat at all. And then just in the hours prior to like these 911 calls coming in, we have a hissing, a buzzing and banging within the radiators. You know, later in litigation, as we are investigating Dan's case, our expert, Douglas Carpenter, one of the things that really stood out to Doug was the fact that a manual boiler, so a boiler that really required someone to keep up with it and to manually feed the water into that boiler to make sure that it wasn't overheating, that boiler would have had all of these signs or symptoms if it was malfunctioning in the days and weeks prior to the fire. Unfortunately, these apartment residents were not interviewed until days and weeks after the arson determination.
Before speaking with these folks, the Pittsburgh Arson Squad had called in the ATF to assist with the investigation.
These are 2 ATF agents that investigated the Greg Brown case, William Petritis and Jason Wick. And they're doing the same thing, right? They're making this arson determination very quickly after the fire has been suppressed on visual inspection alone, without the use of any other experts, without ruling out any additional accidental causes, without all of the chemical analysis having been even sent to the ATF laboratory, without witness interviews being completed, and they're not using the NFPA 921, which at that point in 1993 was in its first publication.
The NFPA 921 is the National Fire Protection Association's investigation guide that signaled a paradigm shift toward the scientific method and away from the myths and folklore nonsense that had been handed down by arson investigation predecessors. Visual cues that were believed to indicate that a fire had been intentionally set with accelerants. Modern science has proved that none of that stuff is true, but it was relied on, and sadly in some places is still relied on, for generations and generations and generations. We'll have our coverage of arson investigation on Wrongful Conviction Junk Science linked in the episode description as well. But anyway, these ATF agents totally ignored this paradigm shift from myth to science and instead searched for support for that determination that they'd already made. And they interviewed some of the people who worked at these buildings.
So the Regal apartment building and the Columbia apartment building are connected in the basement via several locked doors. In the Regal apartment building, there was a can of lacquer thinner near kind of like the back end of the basement. One of the maintenance men tells investigators, "I can't find that can. It may have been moved." Later, they find a can of lacquer thinner in the maintenance room of the Columbia apartment building. And that starts to turn the wheels for investigators that that must have been the can of lacquer thinner that was originally stored in the Regal apartment building. Although there are lots and lots of chemicals in this maintenance room. There is like insecticide, there's gasoline, there's a charcoal grill, there's lacquer thinner. There's no reason to believe that like this can of lacquer thinner was intentionally moved by a perpetrator. It simply could have been moved by one of the maintenance men, of which there were several, or just a different can of lacquer thinner. But that piques the investigators' interest.
Then Petritis and Wick sent 15 samples from the building to their boy in the ATF lab, William Kennard.
William Kennard has a conversation with William Petritis prior to finalizing his report. And he says that in samples 3, 9, 10, and 6, there are elements that lead him to believe that there was a presence of lacquer thinner, which was used as an accelerant to start this fire.
And now what they needed was the right suspect. At this point, they had heard from a guy named Chris Palmieri who found two sets of keys and blank checks from the Columbia in front of one of the building owners' homes. And this information was leaked to the local media, which piqued the interest of Dan's roommates, Keith Playtech and Tammy Mancini.
The only thing that attached him to the Columbia apartment buildings at the time was Tammy Mancini and Keith Playtech saying, you know, that they found these checks.
Yeah, they found checks under the mattress of the bed I slept in, but they were old. They just happened to have that address on them. So
when Dan was interviewed about that, you know, he readily admitted, yes, this was my cash cow. I stole checks from this place. So the police say, "We need your jacket for testing." He says, "Take my jacket for testing." They say, "Sit down for a polygraph test." He sits down for a polygraph test.
Oh, and to add, they lost the coat and they lost the polygraph test.
Both items cleared Dan, but if they hadn't, surely they would have been saved. Additionally, Dan had his alibi and no way of having been able to get into these buildings.
Every exterior door to this building was locked. The maintenance room where they say the fire started was locked. The office where two blank checks and keys that are later found on the owner of the building's doorstep after this fire was locked. The room in the Regal building where Liz was describing, you name your accelerant that's in this room, okay? Locked. The access to the Regal building is an L2x4 over the door. Can't get into it. Everywhere down to this basement, locked. And everybody tells them this. August Peluso, the owner of the building, Orlando Siriambelli, who's the person who actually goes in and locks the doors that night, and Ron Altieri, who's one of the maintenance people at the time, all say everything's locked. Dan has only ever taken checks from an outdoor courtyard.
So if this had been arson, the assailant either had to have had keys or have broken in somehow. So the witness interviews continued, and one building resident, Paul Parter, said that he had heard a party going on that night, which corroborated a statement from a guy named Sean Maxwell.
On January 18th of 1993, the day after this fire, Sean Maxwell comes forward and says, "The guy named Larry Steele shows up to my house a few hours after this fire. He's covered in soot, talking about how he broke into this Columbia apartment building with some friends. They were drinking. And he says, 'We burned down the building by accident. If you tell anybody about it, I will kill you and I will kill your grandmother.'" Sean Maxwell tells police investigators, "I know who did it and I know the name of the guy that he was with. His name was Rob Zacharias." While this is going on, a couple other witnesses in the neighborhood, and you have to understand Pittsburgh to really grasp this. Bloomfield is an old Italian town in Pittsburgh, and everybody knows everybody in the neighborhood. And one of the things that these individual residents are talking about is that there is an individual with long, sandy blonde hair, shoulder length, and an army field jacket that we don't know, who's watching this fire. They actually create a composite sketch, and this individual matches one of two people. First, Rob Zacharias, who was the same individual that Larry Steele said earlier he was with that night. Second, a former maintenance man by the name of Glenn Spoon, who is fired from the property a year ago, but Paul Potter says is spotted a day or two before this fire. And one of the only individuals other than the owner of the building who have keys to those locked rooms. He matches the description of the composite sketch.
Two more individuals were identified who also match this description. However, who even knows if this stranger had anything to do with the fire? Or if Larry Steele had ever even made this confession about him or about Rob Zacharias, considering that this fire, in all likelihood, was a tragic accident, the presence of this alleged suspect with sandy blonde hair and an army field jacket had both dubious value and was also definitely not Dan. The description said 5'10", and Dan is 6'4", so that's not even close. And it appears that yet another witness named Shane Evans confirmed that.
Shane Evans grew up with Dan Carnevale, would know him from 100 yards away, would know him from 100 inches away. Shane Evans is watching the fire happen on January 17th, 1993, 4 a.m., 4:15. Around 5 a.m., he leaves the fire. He finds a fire personnel, and he says to them, "I was walking by the Columbia about 5 minutes before the fire broke out. I heard a door close of the Columbia apartment building. I turned around in a very well-lit area. Could not see his face. The person was unknown to me, but had sandy long blonde hair, shoulder length, and an army field jacket." And fire personnel say, "Go tell police investigators."
So Shane Evans did exactly that. He told three investigators what he had seen.
Yeah. Wait till you hear what he said 13 years later.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
I'm Ilya Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together. We'll cry together and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
After Dan cooperated to the fullest with law enforcement, his jacket tested negative for accelerants, he passed a polygraph, which has limited value, but still, he was released. And he grew a bit cold on Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh was bad for me. All my friends were dying of overdoses. Everybody was dying of China White and heroin and this and that. I had to get away. I couldn't take it anymore. The police were at my parents' house every other day about something stupid. Most of it I knew nothing about. About a month or so after that, I moved to California. I have a friend that lives out there in Humboldt County. I called the police from California and told them I was there. That, you know, if you need me for any further questioning, this is where I'm at. It wasn't like I was living in the mountains hiding from anybody. I just wanted to start over. So I left.
The case went cold for nearly 14 years. And during that time, Dan had built himself a happy, comfortable life.
I had a family. I had a wife. I had stepkids. I had a house. I had a good job. I was working in a lumber mill, $80,000 to $85,000 a year. I finally was doing good in my life, finally. And then everything went downhill.
In early 2006, Pittsburgh Police cold case detectives Scott Evans and J.R. Smith inexplicably reopened the 1993 Columbia Fire investigation.
They do a huge press release where Scott Evans and J.R. Smith release all of the information that we've talked about so far out to the news. Then they put a $10,000 reward in the paper for anybody for information. And 13 years later, on a $10,000 reward in this press release, they talked to Shane Evans, who says, now in this well-lit area, I saw 6'4" Dan Carnevale face-to-face leaving that Columbia apartment building. They asked Shane Evans, in 1993, did you know who Dan Carnevale was? And Shane Evans, of course, says, I grew up with him my whole life, 100%, it was him. And I was watching the fire later, and he came up to me unsolicited, unprovoked, and screamed out loud, I was at the sandwich shop. When he testifies at trial, he says those same things, except he also says, and by the way, Dan Carnevale was covered with soot. Now, let's remember some of the things that we've talked about so far. Dan Carnevale had told everybody his alibi that he was at the sandwich shop after being at the Luna Bar. We also know from the criminal investigation file that Larry Steele, in his confession, was covered in soot. Shane Evans is receiving information somewhere from someone to add those two pieces of information into this situation when he told everybody in 1993, when the fire was still going, that he did not recognize the person.
All of a sudden, in 2006, it was me. He saw me.
$10,000 can be pretty persuasive. And meanwhile, the state disposed of those original statements from 1993 in which Evans had said he couldn't identify the suspect, only sharing this 2006 statement, which garnered the arrest warrant.
I was coming home from work one day, riding up to my house, and I knew there was a helicopter following me, and it was driving all the way up Route 50 until I got close to my house. And then the car pulled out beside me, and the lights went on. And then I seen the Pennsylvania badges, and then I was like, oh, what the hell? So then they started questioning me about the fire. I told them a million times that I did not do this. You're making a mistake. But all they kept doing was yelling at me. Well, think about the people that are dead. Well, think about what you're doing. You're arresting the wrong person. So, you know what I mean? That's all they kept telling me. I didn't know what to tell them. Finally, I said, let me have an attorney. I don't want to talk to y'all anymore. Next thing you know, I'm sitting in the county jail.
And now emerges a jailhouse informant by the name of Sean Burns. Here's what Sean Burns tells everybody. In all of this time, Dan Carnevale explains to Sean Burns, this individual in protective custody, the Allegheny County Jail, that I didn't mean to burn down the building. But what happened was I was at the bar and somebody told me that it's possible that in the future they might put video surveillance on the Columbia apartment building. And so in order to get ahead of them setting up video surveillance, I'm going to break into the Columbia and I'm going to go into the office, but I don't find any video surveillance. It's not there, but just out of an abundance of caution, I'm going to take this can of lacquer thinner and I'm going to douse the office, not the maintenance room, the office, with this whole can. And then I'm going to light a match. I'm going to throw it behind me and I'm going to walk out with the can of lacquer thinner, get rid of it. And hopefully that fire will contain itself in that office and burn the video surveillance equipment that I couldn't find and that I don't know exists. And in the process, I'm going to take two blank checks and a set of keys that belong to the owner and then go set them down on the doorstep of the owner's building.
The alleged motive was as far-fetched as it was inconsistent with the ATF's theory, which, if their theory is to be believed, then why was Burns alleging that Dan burned the office, not the maintenance room, and then left with the lacquer thinner when the can was in fact found in the building? Either way, Sean Burns did not make this statement for free.
Sean Burns had gun charges. He also had some kid charges, some child rape things. And if he would have went to state prison, he wouldn't have made it through. So he was doing anything he could do to come up with getting himself out of jail. And he got out of jail 4 days after my trial.
What we later find out, Sean Burns has not only testified in Daniel Carnevale's case during 2007, he's testified on behalf of the Commonwealth as an informant in two other cases just that year.
For the same prosecutor.
For the very same prosecutor. You got the deal of a century for serial cooperation.
So it seems like this prosecutor, Jennifer DiGiovanni, was willing to overlook the inconsistencies in Burns' statement to try to close the Columbia Fire case. And with Shane Evans and Sean Burns in her back pocket, she offered Dan 3.5 to 7 years. Pretty incredible deal, if you think about it, if she really thought he was guilty of a triple murder.
I wasn't taking a plea. I wouldn't care what they were giving me. I didn't do it, and I'm not taking a plea. I really thought that there was no way they could find someone guilty that wasn't guilty. I found out the hard way I was wrong.
Dan went to trial in August 2007 with his attorney, Frank Walker. And in addition to Evans and Burns, ATF agent William Petritis testified from memory. Right, 14 years removed from the investigation, he testified from memory. The physical evidence had all been destroyed, making it impossible to do a full reinvestigation. Meanwhile, Petritis was sure that an alleged assailant started the blaze with lacquer thinner in the maintenance room, backing his claims up with ancient arson gobbledygook.
He says that the thing that really stood out to him was the low burn patterns that were present on like the doorway of the mechanical room, which today we know low burn patterns are not indicative of an unnaturally or an accelerant set fire. We know that if the structure reaches full room involvement, meaning flashover, that low burn patterns are absolutely naturally occurring. But Petritis's testimony, you know, led the jury to believe that these low burn patterns were unnaturally occurring, were indicative of only a fire that could have been set through the use of an accelerant.
And this non-scientific observation was then backed up by allegedly scientific analysis from ATF chemist William Kennard, whose credibility was falling apart in the lead up to Dan's trial. In 2006, three fire scientists were hired to examine his analysis of an alleged arson in Indiana, the notorious Christine Bunch case, in which he said there was presence of an accelerant in her son's bedroom, when in fact there was none.
And William Kennard is really exposed as having falsified reports. We know that in August 2007, the ATF is asked to reevaluate William Kennard's original chemical analysis in Dan's 1993 case. Chief Julia Dolan reevaluates all of the gas chromatographs, and she says that the levels of lacquer thinner are so low as to be meaningless. She disagrees with every single finding Kennard has reported. That report that Julia Dolan does is not shared with defense counsel.
But the Julia Dolan memo is dated August of 2007. And Dan was tried August 26th and August 27th of 2007. So somebody knew, somebody had the information, but Jennifer DiGiovanni gets Frank Walker, criminal defense attorney, to just stipulate, hey, you don't want to go get a expert. Let's just accept the ATF. Just stipulate. Don't get an expert. This is legit.
And then Petraitis just reads in William Kennard's original chemical analysis, telling the jury that lacquer thinner has been found in, you know, all of these samples.
And so that evidence was always just assumed to be 100% true.
And then with all of the information that was withheld from defense counsel, any of the alternative perpetrators, the Steele alleged confession, and Julia Dolan ATF report saying that the lacquer thinner conclusion was meaningless.
Dan was convicted of arson, burglary, aggravated assault, and 3 counts of second-degree murder. So instead of 3.5 years, he got 3 consecutive life sentences.
My trial lasted one day, by the way. I mean, I had a triple homicide. I picked a jury one day, was found guilty the next. I was just shocked. I was in shock for probably the first year.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of 2, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums, but I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights' sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My personality got me through prison. I could be a comedian because I had to make it to where I wasn't going to get in trouble in jail or have enemies or whatever. I just did the best I could. I was in a supermax prison. You know, I had 3 life sentences. it's bugging me right now. I can't get it out of my fucking head. Just hearing all the stuff that they did to me over and over. It's, you know, why? They had enough stuff to prove me innocent, but they lost it all. A little strange, ain't it?
Like, let's just recap. They alleged to have lost the jacket that Dan turned over for testing as to whether he had any kind of, like, trace of accelerants on his jacket. They do not have the polygraph that Dan took, which, you know, indicated that he was not being deceptive. At trial, they testified that they lost any indication that Shane Evans had come forward on the night of the fire and made original police statements.
Yet the original statements turned up years later, in which Shane Evans, who knew Dan Carnevale, could not identify the man he saw. Rather, Evans had described someone who did not match Dan's profile. But before those statements were discovered, Dan's earlier appeals focused on information Dan had received about Sean Burns.
This guy sent me a message to my cell saying that he wanted to talk to me out in the yard about something really important. I'm starting to stress out what the hell is wrong now. So I go out in the yard and he tells me, hey, did you ever hear of David Dixon? And I said, no. Then he goes, well, do you know Jennifer DiGiovanni? I said, yes, why? And then he started explaining that she put him in jail and they had Sean Burns as the jailhouse informant, blah, blah, blah. And he ended up getting 20 years and he just wanted to let me know that it happened to him too.
David Dixon, who had spent time with Sean Burns, swore an affidavit that Burns had admitted fabricating Dan's alleged confession, which became part of a post-conviction relief motion along with the sweetheart deal Burns had received. 14 months and immediate parole eligibility. He was released 4 days after Dan's trial. However, both Dan's post-conviction motion and his habeas were denied by 2016, by which point the Pennsylvania Innocence Project had reviewed Dan's case and Liz paid him a visit.
Once Liz came to see me for the first time, everything changed. I knew that something was going to happen because I was innocent. I don't even know what to say to Liz anymore because she's just like best thing that ever happened to me. I'm sorry.
Love you too. And our first step was to retain our expert, Douglas Carpenter. And he did that review pro bono. Even though we were missing quite a bit of documentation, he really laid out for the court the evolution of the NFPA 921, of how fire science and fire investigation, what would have been done in 2017 that just was not done in 1993, was not even conceptualized in 1993, and alleged that this fire should not have been determined an arson or intentionally set, that at the very least, it should have been undetermined. And his theory was that it was an accidental fire and that the boiler overheated, causing superheating within the joists. And he, you know, talked very much about like the steam pipes and how they ran throughout the building, how they ran straight up into that northwest corner that collapsed, the ways in which witness statements afterwards really supported the fact that this could have been an accidental boiler overheating.
But the state argued that this was just a battle of experts and their petition was denied. However, Liz's work on Greg Brown's case, another canard victim, by the way, appears to have been the catalyst that brought the Julia Dolan report in Dan's case to light in 2019.
I can't say exactly what happened here, but if I had to assume, that assistant U.S. attorney in Greg Brown's case requested all of the ATF files, arson files, that were conducted in Allegheny County throughout a specific time period. So 1990 to 1995, right? One of those case files was Dan Carnevale's. And within that ATF case file was that Julia Dolan report saying that the lacquer thinner results that were originally reported in Kennard's 1993 report were meaningless. That was then turned over to the PCRA attorney that was working on Dan Carnevale's case. And thank goodness for the ethics of that PCRA prosecutor, because they turned it over to us, as they have a constitutional duty to do. And because of that report, the Allegheny County District Attorney's Office agreed that Dan deserved a new trial.
While the DA was deciding whether to even bother with a new trial, Liz reached out to Julia Dolan.
I was able to interview Julia Dolan and ask why in 2007, very coincidentally, in the same month as Dan's trial, did you reevaluate Kennard's report? And the only response I was able to achieve was, I cannot recall. And I was like, was it a specific request from Allegheny County to reevaluate this analysis? Or were you doing a more systemic review of like analysis from this time, from this particular chemist, because he had been discredited in the Bunch case? And she says, I have never done a systemic review of one of my colleagues.
In addition to this Brady violation that should have prevented Dan's 2007 trial from ever happening at all, Liz was now able to locate even more evidence.
In the district attorney's response to our PCRA petition, one of the attachments was a document from the insurance agency that represented the owner of the Columbia building. And it gave me the actual name, which was Northwestern National Insurance. Many times, especially in these arson cases, the insurance company will do a much more in-depth investigation in order to determine whether they should pay the claim than sometimes the arson squad will. When I tried to locate how many Northwestern National Insurance companies there was like over 200. So I just made a list and started down this list. I think I got to probably 75, maybe 100 calls. When finally I spoke with this woman and I gave her the insurance claim number, and she said, yes, that reflects a claim number that like would have been a claim number that we used at the time. But they were in the process of destroying all of these old documents. And I was like, stop where you are. If you have these old documents, I need them. And so we immediately sent her a subpoena, and she located 6,000 pages of insurance documents. And within that box were those original police reports from Shane Evans that the cold case detective said were lost. And there were three police reports. He did, in fact, speak with three police officers on that night. But despite his trial testimony saying it was light, I immediately recognized it as Daniel Carnevale. His police report said unknown white male did not see face. All three. And so when I presented this, the district attorney's office finally said, we're going to null pros. We're going to petition the court to withdraw all charges. And Dan was finally released and exonerated.
I got released March 18th, the first day of COVID that nobody was allowed out of the house.
It was the very first day of like everybody was being kind of like sent home from your work.
I went out anyway. I was walking all over Pittsburgh. I was taking money and giving $5 bills to homeless people downtown Pittsburgh. So I haven't been in Pittsburgh for 26, 27 years. So I'm back in Pittsburgh. I'm living with my brother, and he's taking good care of me. Like, he bought me a motorcycle. He let me use his car. He helped me get my driver's license. KDK radio station helped me get the job. I mean, there was a lot involved. And I had a house up in Pittsburgh that my parents had, and they had squatters and stuff living in it. So I just went there and cleaned it, and we sold that. And it was pretty crazy when I got out, but life got so good. Then I met my wife, Donna, who's sitting next to me right here. Everything changed. We're on our second home since I got out. You know, just I work 10 hours a day, 6 days a week sometimes, and just I'm loving life.
I will say that when I first met Dan, just the sweetest, most sincere man. And, you know, Dan's case, Greg's case, every case that I work on is the best thing that I could possibly do with my Juris Doctorate. But like knowing that I never have to have a conversation with Dan in those orange uniforms in that mint green room, that's enough. That's enough that I have done with my career. I could stop today.
Dan is the most incredible person that I've ever met. I have a 4-year-old boy, my oldest boy. Dan is a very successful baker. He loves to bake, and he bakes for one of the probably the most famous bakery in all of the Pittsburgh area.
Third best in the country.
Third best in the country on his own dime. Dan surprised my four-year-old's junior pre-kindergarten class with Halloween cookies that he made for them. And then on Thanksgiving, and we, you know, talk, if not every day, every other day, said, you know, Alec, you got to try my homemade pumpkin pie. I do it different.
Cheesecake.
I'm going to get there, Dan. Pumpkin I'm going to get there. And I said, I love pumpkin pie. And he said, it's cheesecake, but I do a special sauce on top. And so my family, my two boys, my wife, we all met Dan. And he gave us this homemade pumpkin pie. And then we called Dan and I said, Dan, let's go to Eaton Park, sort of this well-known Pittsburgh dive. And we get there and Dan's talking about the Super Burgers, raving about a Super Burger.
You're so obsessed with Big Macs and Super Burgers.
Obsessed with it. And I'm like, Dan, fuck the Super Burger. I'm getting turkey dinner. And Dan looks at the waitress and he goes, give me the exact same thing. And then this woman walked over unsolicited. Dan has a Steelers tattoo on the side of his head and said, sir, I love your tattoo. And Dan made a joke to her. She lit up. He is a guy that just makes everything better. You make everything better.
Thank you, Alex.
Okay. So just in case I find myself in Pittsburgh anytime soon, what's the name of this bakery?
Oakmont Bakery, number one in Pittsburgh, for sure. Yeah.
Well, shout out to Oakmont Bakery. We're going to have them linked in the episode description as well. But meanwhile, we wish you all the best in the civil suit as we go now to closing arguments, where, first of all, I thank you guys so much for sharing this story. And then I'm just going to take these next few minutes to sit back in my chair and listen to anything else you feel is left to be said. So let's start with Alec, then Liz, and of course, finally, Dan.
There's nothing really for me to add except to reiterate, you know, Dan, you know, we all love you. This is about you. Others are hurt, but, you know, we're in your fight and you really do make life better. You made my life better. You made my family's life better.
Thank you. I'll bring you some more cookies.
Well, those compliments will only continue as long as you feed me.
Right. Okay, Liz, what do you got to say?
My takeaway, and I express this to Alec quite a bit, is I just don't understand why Dan was targeted, and not even in 1993, right? It was years later in 2006. It feels like more of an effort to target Dan as opposed to actually following the tangible leads that they had. And I feel like, you know, when you lie, when you cover up, you not only have to remember the lies and the cover up that you did, but the lies and the cover up that you asked others to do, which seems much, much more difficult than just conducting a really straightforward and logical investigation. And so I will never understand this case. I will never understand why Dan was targeted, especially because he was out of state. He wasn't in our state. He wasn't in our community. He wasn't causing a problem. He wasn't making enemies. And so I hope someday, Dan, you have an answer to that. I would like to have some answers and to have those particular people who cost you 13, 14 years of your life and all of the trauma that you experienced while you were in prison, answer for that.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say. I just thank God that things happened the way they did at the end. And, you know, I'm just happy to be living my life not inside that hole anymore. I can't understand it. I will never understand it. So that's about all I got to say. Thank you for having me on this show. Liz, thank you for being here. And Alec, you know, I don't know what else. I thought I'd never eat a Big Mac again. I think that's why I like Big Macs so much, you know?
I'll eat a Big Mac with you, Dan.
All right. Well, hell yeah. We could just do Super Burgers.
No, we'll get distracted by a turkey dinner. Let's go get a Big Mac.
They got double ones.
Oh, though, Christ.
Oh, you guys are so gross.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at @itsjasonflom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.